Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast, where we talk about the future of health and explore how technology is poised to reshape healthcare and pharma. I am Thomas, your host and a partner at Strategy End. In our last episode, we talked about longevity, mental health, and the potential of psychedelics to revolutionize mental health treatment with a serial entrepreneur and investor. Today's episode is equally exciting and revolves around quantum computing in pharma. To provide the expertise this complex topic merits, I'm thrilled to be joined by a visionary leader and renowned expert at the forefront of technology innovation in the life sciences industry. A very warm welcome to Clemens Ucik-Ucik, who is the Chief Technology Officer and Head of IT Technology Strategy at Boehringer Ingelheim. In his role, he is responsible for the firm's global technology strategy and quantum computing lab. He is also the mastermind behind BI's engineering-centric citizen development platform, which empowers around 50,000 colleagues to become open innovators through state-of-the-art self-service technology. Clemens' expertise covers a wide range of cutting-edge technologies, including software development, big data, rapid software delivery, advanced computing, virtual and augmented reality, data science, but also quantum computing, which is all contributing to Boehringer Ingelheim's global tech strategy. As a key architect of the transformation of a billion-dollar IT, Clemens was instrumental in Boehringer Ingelheim winning the prestigious 2020 Digital Leader Award from the German CIO magazine named Computerwoche. Prior to his 14-plus years at Boehringer, Clemens held several key positions at Oracle Corporation, including being a senior principal product manager and SOA architect. On the academic front, Clemens holds an MBA in Strategic Management and Innovation from the University of Wales. And he's also a sought-after speaker at various events and has published numerous papers on quantum computing, service-oriented architecture, and technological imperatives for life sciences. Therefore, I'm really thrilled to welcome Clemens as a very renowned technology leader in the pharma industry. Thanks, Clemens, for joining us here in somewhat cloudy Vienna today.
Thank you very much, Thomas, for having me here.
Me kind of elaborating a bit on your impressive career. You have held several prominent roles in IT and technology that might, to some of us, seem overwhelming. And let's say if you were speaking to a room of novelists, philosophers, or people of similar professions that typically do not count exceedingly tech-savvy, how would you describe your role in a basic kind of non-techy way?
My role is about connecting dots. My role is about connecting people with data and technology. It's enabling people to use technology smarter than yesterday. It's helping teams to excel with using technology, providing processes, providing self-service, providing all ideas that make people more technology savvy in order to deliver better business outcomes, because we don't do technology for technology's sake to build raw technology products, but our job is to find and deliver life-saving drug. So my job is to enable teams to deliver those drugs better and faster to the market. That's what I'm doing the whole day on various stages. Every day is different, from teaching to explaining to providing answers on BI's forums to technology problems, to co-shaping the technology strategy with my teams, to helping in a crisis here and there. Many things, many interesting things. So life of a CTO, different than what most people think. Working with senior engineers, advising them, helping them shape the new world. That's what I do.
Sounds pretty complex and thrilling at the same time to kind of be a thought leader, be a connector, an enabler, enabling people to speak to each other, connect with each other, but also wrestle around ideas that they have. I mean, it's a vibrant environment, it sounds like. Huh?
It's a fun, giving job. Of course, with ups and downs. I come from core technology background. And it's seeing people develop, seeing people upskill, seeing people to get glary eyes when they see technology and say, hey, we have this done now much faster than we ever thought we could do it based on technology. And that's kind of the awesome part of it. That's the piece that is giving back. Also in lieu of looking forward to how can we make drug design and drug discovery faster and better with cutting edge technologies like large language models, Gen AI, Quantum, and many other things there.
And we'll surely dive into that in a second. And you mentioned that you come from another major US software and hardware manufacturer, Oracle, and you are now part of the senior management at a leading German pharma company named Boehringer Ingelheim. As you have been exposed but also experienced both those corporate cultures on a day-to-day basis, what is kind of the distinctive difference or also parallels between those two US tech and hardware-driven company versus a family-owned Boehringer Ingelheim based in Germany? I mean, how to understand those companies? What are parallels and differences, as I said?
I think if you look at largely US tech companies, all of them are listed one or the other way at the stock exchange at NASDAQ, right? So you get used to the stock heartbeat. You get used to many things, right? Out of the Silicon Valley culture, we worked literally next to or within the proximity of the Silicon Valley there. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the next every single day, right? What is it? What is the next to build an even better product, right? To build an, at the very end, sort of, you need to outrun your competition, number one, but number two, also your users, right? Because they always expect the next from you that will make them better. That was sort of the fun part there, and delivering a product largely from scratch with an ingenious gang or group of people that I still hold very, very dear. A few of them have become over the many years friends of mine that I still see in a very private context. And again, right, you're competing head to head against the Googles, the AWSs, of this world. And that's cool. That's awesome. On the other side, I mean, obviously you provide product, right? And people build always something on top, right? They use it as foundational components. In my case, that was Oracle SOA Suite and Oracle Integration Backbone. And you see people all around the world using it to build and to solve the real business problem with it, right? Use of sort of a technology problem, and then you see others solving a business challenge with it. It was cool, but there is also sort of the difference to Boehringer, because suddenly we are on the user side there, right?
Yep.
Our job is to kind of provide business outcome. Our job is to make drug design faster, to make commercial processes better, more integrated, to help the shared service center being built. So that's part one. Part two is sort of the difference between the NASDAQ stock beat on the one side and on the other side, being family owned.
Yep.
That is a major difference. A major difference. We invest in decades. We think in generations, quite literally. If you look at how long it takes for a drug to get from an inception and the idea to the market, we talk 10, 12 years. Talk about massive privately invested risk capital.
Yep.
So an entirely different game. So I think both want to, where the commonality is having both relying massively on skill and attitude. Slightly different, but at the very end, the best technology is useless without amazing people that apply it or build it or develop it or think it. And where they are different is obviously on the NASDAQ beat and on the family corporation, and obviously also their purpose, right? One part is to create amazing technology to make the world indexable, searchable, and whatnot. And the other part is save lives. Save lives for generations, which is actually an awesome purpose.
And speaking about purpose, in prepping to today's session that we're having, you mentioned in a previous interview also that you are having a lifelong passion for physics. Would be good to share a bit of a personal kind of specific moment or experience why this actually evolved in the past for you. Is that one of the happenings that you had in childhood or whatever, or did it emerge over time that you generated that interest and kept it throughout your career?
In school, I was always like rather on the weird side, I think. And I remember my math and physics professor there, which got me excited because it was somebody I could kind of build stuff, right? One part was with math and the other one was really touch stuff, right? You touch a laser, you see how beam splitting works and play around with gravity and others. And I was just super excited by it, which then led me also to specialize in physics for my final two classes. And then I tried actually to study physics at the Technical University of Vienna, not far away from where we are right now. And honestly, I was too stupid for it. because I could not self-organize me. You come out of a pretty good middle school, right? And high school, and suddenly you're sort of on your own, go organize university studies.
Yeah.
And I failed. So I actually started to work, and I started to work at Oracle, first in consulting, and then all the rest of my career started to emerge. But I think the interesting part is it never let go. Mm-hmm. It was always there. It was always like this super interesting part to understand the world better and better and better and build a model around it. Like, how could this work? I'm still today, when I try new stuff, I'm a lot on the playing side. Mm-hmm. Understand? Mm-hmm. Like, I want to like not just read it. I want to play with it and see how does a ball behave in vacuum? How does gravity work, right? And whatnot. And so that excitement and interest and whatnot kept with me with having a computer science background then and developing computer science background and many other things. And so actually it was my teacher in school. I have to say it was my teacher in school that helped me to develop this love for physics. And when we published the Nature of Physics perspective then on quantum computing, many years after that, yeah. I met her at the classical concert in Vienna by pure accident. And I told her and said, "And you know what's all the reason why I'm here today with physics is you." And she smiled. And she managed to get me excited.
And it's impressive that it kept you as a kind of a lifelong player and learner, it sounds like, right? So you're exploring this from that few moments that you had in school, obviously. Yeah? Now, you are in your role as a CTO at Boehringer, or the CTO, you're steering the global strategy around technology for, as said, a family-owned pharma company with a 140-year history and a long tradition. How do you balance this very rich heritage that Boehringer has with the need for cutting-edge technology and innovation that merits, obviously, also things to be done differently, things to unlearn and learn new stuff, new capabilities, new talents, new operating models to acquaint for what's needed. Now, how do you combine this heritage?
I think one is to understand it. That heritage, the 140 years in the making, gave us, and most people just don't know, so much data. We are using data and databases, to pick one example, since 60-plus years. So we are sitting on this super rich foundation, and albeit most people kind of don't think it that way, we are used to use technology. I think it's more about how do we deal with technology adaptation and adopting technology versus risk. Mm-hmm. So what most people obviously see of us is sort of the risk-averse Boehringer. Well, granted, because we touch lives literally. Absolutely. And metabolism, right? Yeah. But many of the colleagues and people I talk to every day, they have that... that child that wants to play. And I think our job is to unleash it. Our job is to have a quality management system, for example, that allows that child to play until something becomes serious and getting sort of closer to the metabolism. This is something I had to learn, right? I came off Oracle, way different culture, way different, many other things, very outspoken, very direct, very candid. And on the other side, a long-lasting, long-standing, multi-generation family business, it's about convincing people. Mm-hmm. It's about showing. And to some extent, you have to look outside. Mm-hmm. No matter where you are right now, the world is changing. It's changing at rapid speed, faster than ever before, I think. And technology is at the very heart of it. And suddenly, that's our new world, or the world of ChatGPT, that made knowledge flat.
Yeah.
Knowledge is not power anymore. Today, knowledge is flat. And that's kind of awesome. Mm-hmm. You need to learn how to learn. You need to learn how to, I think, understand how to... if I ask my teachers from school, what he always told us was, my job is not to teach you knowledge. My job is to teach you how to learn. Mm-hmm. And that was a painful ride. But it was exactly what we need today. You need to be able to understand, is this... hallucinated? Is this actually credible data?
Yeah.
Is this something that is biased? How much is it biased, if at all, right? Because, I mean, the world is biased. Every thought of mine is biased, and of yours as well. But understand this. And I think developing this understanding, that's sort of the key. Like, if I would tell people today, and ask me, like, what should I learn? Well, learn foundations, right? Mm-hmm. Learn how to learn. Learn data structures. Learn algorithmic thinking. That will get you pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. This gives you a basis for for remaining resilient? Because you don't get just the one job in life anymore, right? So you need to be a lifelong player, a lifelong learner in the end.
And even I started when I joined Boehringer, I started on the business side, which helped a lot in hindsight to understand what the heck we were actually doing all day. I really appreciate the value chain. And then I went sort of back to a more technology-centric role into IT marketing and sales and then
that's interesting.
Other things.
Which part of the business did you join?
Global Business Services.
Oh, wow.
I actually helped to shape Global Business Services, ran master data management there with my team, built it up. That's the reason why we have global supplier management and many other things. But it was, for me, it was like mind-blowing because obviously it was all, and it is all SAP-based, right? It was the business support for the global, at that point, still R3-based template. Today it's S4. And it just gave... I learned a lot of knowledge today of being able to connect dots. You connect dots across towers, you connect dots across businesses. Mm-hmm. But well, for connecting dots, you better understand sort of the value chain and the many contexts. We're a knowledge company, we're also a network company. And I think a lot of the people I met in the first 3-4 years are still the people that I work with, not every day now, but every month or so, to see what they are up to, right? To really kind of also derive a meaningful technology strategy that powers and backs business.
And one of those technologies that not as bespoke yet like AI is obviously quantum computing, which is also one of your expertise, right? And this is obviously giving the promise of fundamentally changing how we process information today at a much more light speed than what we are used to today. Could you explain somewhat that technology for our listeners, but also for myself, obviously, how to understand this? What is this technology, but also how do you actually currently use that on a practical level already today?
So quantum. Quantum is super exciting because our world is quantum mechanical. I mean, assuming that Richard Feynman and many others were correct and Erwin Schrödinger, our world is quantum mechanics, right? So it's sort of the more or less logical view to say, hey, if I have one quantum mechanical system that is a quantum box, should be much easier to simulate another quantum mechanical system, which is a molecule or body and anything in between, right? And how molecules interact and whatnot, which is sort of also going back to a very piece of the core of what we are doing at Boehringer, right? For the readers, many of you guys likely have not heard anything about pharmaceutical research, but think of it that way. First part is to really identify what is causing a disease. Very likely it's an enzyme, a protein in the enzyme chain. And if you want to visualize it more sort of from a picture point of view, think of it as a lock. And what we try, the drug is sort of a key. So we try to design the best perfect key for that, right? And that key may open the lock, it may kind of literally blow up the lock, or it may actually sit there and never get out of it again. And that sort of, this binding is sort of exactly what we're looking for, because it has many, many effects to the outer workings of the drug, right? How much, how little, side effects, many other things. And being able to calculate this much faster than today and a much higher quality than we have today, that is approximative, driven by machine learning and AI, is what we intend to do with quantum. So here's sort of the reasoning behind. So assuming Richard Feynman was correct, which I dearly hope he got the Nobel Prize for it, there should be a way to make it work. Now our job is to make quantum work for pharma. That's sort of my team's or the quantum lab's job, if you will, why we go after this. So that was sort of part one. Part two, so there's sort of like, and I talk about really quantum computers, not annealers and any other thing, but there's sort of two worlds. One is actually a more analog type world, where you really try to do sampling, have fermions at hand, and that you manipulate and really look at sort of interactions. And the other part is the digital quantum world that we are heavily looking to, right? And if for nothing else, think of a quantum computer as just something that can ridiculously fast calculate the metrics. And that's sort of what we want to use it for, because many of the things or that we talk in quantum chemistry about are driven by probabilities. They are driven by a probability if some chunk of orbital is left, right, up, or down in the sphere, right? Well, what if we could actually model this directly? The ability to model, if you kind of layman term, use and calculate and model probabilities. It's much easier on a quantum computer than on a binary computer, because a binary computer, 0 and 1. Well, that's not a probability, right? It's either 0 or 1.
Yes.
So it's 100% left or 100% down. And a quantum box, think you'd be able to attach a probability to that and calculate with sort of that probability at the same time. That is what makes quantum computers faster. It's still a long way to go. So where do you use it for real? Today, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because we neither have the hardware yet at the scale we need, nor are the algorithms that we every day co-invent at the speed we need to have them to actually beat the classical experiment or to give us more insight at the same time than the classical calculation that we do today with approximation with machine learning. So that's where we are. It's research. It's really applied research. So I have the luxury, albeit never managed to study physics, to have actually be part of an amazing research lab of
this really cutting edge scientists.
And that's really, 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 really cool. I mean, hey, you work in a pharmaceutical, right? On the one hand, you help to shape technology strategy. And on the other hand, you're suddenly in this like research group type setting, right? You submit papers, you talk with researchers all day long. The guys speak at conferences. You make progress. We see that progress being made from very early. This is going to be like just way, way, way too long in terms of possible runtime execution to like, we get closer and closer and closer every day.
And this is such a moment where I sometimes would wish a podcast would have a video because you can really see the sparkling in your eyes when you talk about it, right? So just for you online and listening, really exciting. And if we talk about quantum, I mean, obviously, let's talk about roadblocks and enablers to kind of get it, right? And with that, also the question, when is actually prime time coming for quantum? Is it possible to approximate it yet, given that hardware not at a scale where we need it, algorithms not in a place, how we need it? What's your best guess?
So when we went to the board a couple of years back, we said by the end of the decade, we will know. We will know if it's kind of working or not. Because at that point, we predicted and believed that hardware would be available. Mm-hmm. And I stand by that.
Okay.
So by end of the decade, we should have the first boxes with enough of quality qubits that stand long enough with little to no errors to do calculations. And I always say, like, I don't want to have this like Stone Age effect where people were standing around or sitting around a cave and suddenly you had a lightning stroke and then fire emerged and people were burning their hands on it, and having no idea whatsoever what that thing is, never mind how to tame it. And that's the reason why we do all the algorithm research, because the best qubits don't help me anything if I have no idea how to apply them to a real problem. And actually, that is sort of the focus on the quantum lab that we run, to make the algorithms faster and really cover real-world problems and not just artificial-type problems. There's enough sort of artificial-type problems to prove sort of quantum computing can work. Mm-hmm. That's great. If something took, like, I don't know, the lifetime of a universe, and now we got it down to like 1,000 years, that's kind of awesome for someone in the academic world. In the more business-driven world, it's kind of not that awesome. So that's sort of our job, right? To really take the stuff then and make it industrially, quote-unquote, usable. So I think for now, we see hardware platforms emerging and progressing. There's still no clear winner, I would say. Literally all of the technologies out there have sort of their merits and reversely their problems. Mm-hmm. How to scale them, how to make ions faster, for example, more they're super well controllable. On the other side, they are just slow and the ion traps are slow versus superconducting, which is lightning speed. Mm-hmm. Then you have all the photonic world currently that is their neutral atoms. Super interesting technologies. We don't know yet which one's going to make it. And maybe it's going to be actually a bunch of them for different type use cases, different type lifetimes of algorithms. We'll have to see. On the algorithm side, again, right, much the focus right now is on what we call sort of ground state energy of a single geometry, but we talked about it. The quantum mechanics is about distributions, about probabilities, right? And so if you think about the classical world to view and look at a molecule, it's sort of this geometry, right? And everybody has in mind like a geometry of a hexagon or whatever else. But it's not that one. It's actually gazillions of them at the same time, which we call conformers. And actually, that ensemble of things defines you, the shape properties and whatnot. And being able to express that, to calculate that more efficient than we do it classically, that's hard. It's hard research, but we get there every day.
And before we get probably also into imagination around how we can use this in the pharma industry and how to apply it once it is there, after talking about quantum, what would you, from your experience, think are the additional, let's say, 2 to 3 technologies that one should have in mind when thinking pharma of the future?
I think it's speech and other biomarkers. Mm-hmm. And not quote-unquote the classical biomarkers that are largely blood or substance-driven. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting one. especially around cognitive disease or maybe biomarkers actually that one actually can get to see if there's cognitive impairment that is a leap way towards understanding if there's some other disease emerging. That's part one. We also, way different game, but data lineage, data traceability, data understanding and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I know a wide open topic and gazillions of technologies, but I think the ability to connect data smartly, wisely, while reversely keeping it exactly where I want, mm-hmm. my data, my place, super interesting. So all sorts of data privacy technologies, also in the context of a global world mm-hmm. that unfortunately is becoming a little less global right now and actually more national.
Yeah.
So we see actually obviously all sort of data privacy laws emerging in countries. So suddenly you can't ship a piece of data out of that country anymore. So you have to think about tokenization technologies and whatnot, which is something that privately excites me anyway. And also when it comes to machine learning, how do you deal with federated learning or actually not centralized learning mm-hmm. and the ability to actually get to the raw training data? Because that's sort of the worst thing that can happen. You train it and then you ship it and someone says, like, I got the raw data you trained with. Oops. So that's sort of what I'm looking to. And the other part, sort of inspiry-wise, is also to look towards neuromorphic computing, right? More computing like our brain works mm-hmm. to see what's possible with that.
Cool. You gave me something to think along the lines of you need to be able to connect data at the same time you need to have data staying where it is, right? So it's a lot to do with security, a lot to do with trust, a lot to do with new technology that gives you that comfort to do the one while remaining the other.
And we see this. We see this with LLMs, right? They are trained on large language models. They are trained on gazillion of data points. And one is actually IP rights. Big question mark, right? Mm-hmm. When you get something out that you want to resell, who owns the IP, right? How the entire argument of patents and really having differentiating patents earlier to suddenly something that is extremely close where you don't have the ties, where the thing's coming from. I mean, it's an entire research field, an entire academic research field. And I met a couple of the guys that research into this, and there is way more open than it's actually closed. So like, if you want to talk at the same level of quantum, they are at sort of the same level in terms of like all the questions that are just open. It's wide, but it's also pretty interesting, I guess.
And probably moving from there, it is really clear that we are at an extraordinary era that is characterized by scientific advancements unprecedented speed, data availability that is unparalleled, computing power, as you rightly put it, is on the brink of significant scaling. And additionally, there is a growing also openness to collaboration and many exciting partnerships between industry and institutional players at the same time. This obviously sets also the stage for remarkable innovation, both in disease treatment, but also healthcare as such. A, I would be interested in what is your perspective on this? And B, this is obviously a very good fundament for sparking innovation in the pharma and healthcare industry. What are critical kind of ingredients in this? And what are also obstacles to overcome when we talk about institutional and industry players embarking into ecosystems and partnerships in order to make this work?
I think you have to see healthcare much bigger than just say a pill or a substance mm-hmm. or a drug. You have to think about the life of a patient, the life of a disease and what it does to people that suffer that, especially chronic disease. And you have to kind of latch on to many, many of those points of gain and also points of fail, of doubt, of pain, of many other things. So we have to go beyond. And that is, we have to think about point of care. We have to think about a long-term type care thing, right? What can we give people that suffer a chronic disease to make their life easier? I'm in the unfortunate or reversely, I don't know, fortunate situation that I'm beyond CTO. I'm also husband and caregiver. Mm. My wife suffers a nasty chronic autoimmune disease. And you see like all the things that are around that taking a pill. It's all about the organization of a day. It's organization of primary care, of secondary care physicians, about how much can they help you finding the right ones, the drugs you have at home and how do they interact and intersect, and many of these topics. And I think that's sort of the big question to us is how do you guys fit into that larger life of a chronic disease mm-hmm. and what can you do with it to ease that potentially beyond the drug, beyond the substance. And very likely it's not just an app that does something, but it's really to understand that. How can we make life of these patients better beyond just the drug? And with whom do we have to partner? It's not about doing all that stuff ourselves, but can we partner with people, with institutions that help people to cope better with their disease, right? And technology enable them and whatnot, in albeit being in this obviously rightly so regulated industry and regulated market. That is sort of one of the things that keep us truly awake at night, because obviously people get, or there is pressure to the healthcare systems from a cost perspective and whatnot. And that's sort of what I also tell people quite often. Like, listen, we are putting insane amounts of risk money down in order to develop these drugs. Be aware of that. That is risk capital. I mean, this is VC at scale in order to find this one piece that we hopefully get to the market. And I think this working with institutions on getting access to biomarker data on great scale, on getting access to longevity data, right? So pretty much data from people over many years, where we see the genome, where we see omics progressing, changing, to really develop this way more intimate understanding of what's happening there towards a disease, maybe even able to predict that disease way in advance. Because if you look at nasty things like dementia or so cognitive impairment type diseases, Alzheimer, ALS, there's little to no way back right now. And I think the faster we can diagnose it, at least we have a way to halt it then.
Yeah.
And that's on the way to the cure, sort of the first viable step.
And I think you hit a super important point. I mean, taking Alzheimer's as one example, right? It's any of the drugs that is currently on the market, was led newly on the market recently, like aducanumab and others, they need to be given at a very early stage of the disease, right? So really at the onset. So people being in their early 50s. Yeah?
If not 30s or 40s.
If not younger.
For sure.
They need to be found at a different stage in their life, in their private life, because they're not aware of being diseased at this stage. They're ignoring this. They don't want to accept it at this stage. But this is where you need to find them. So it's not happening only at a doctor's place. It needs to be somewhere in the normal life of a person where you can see this, right?
You touch, I don't know, want it or not, on a very interesting problem at the intersection to technology. Because on the one hand, we have a dramatic shortage and a predicted shortage of general practitioners. Mm-hmm. I mean, there the age pyramid is like, And everybody I talk to that studies in one or the other fashion medicine wants to become secondary specialty care doctor. That's kind of awesome. But how does that fit to the healthcare system as a whole? And also to the Charter of the Human Rights, equal access to healthcare. And the second part is, do you want to have an app telling you that you have Alzheimer's? I don't.
Me neither.
No, and like this, this intersection where when we talk about technology and beyond that, right, about the human aspect of life, of care, of diagnosis and whatnot, that is so, so, so important. And here we have to find smarter ways to kind of unlock all the today wasted time that these doctors have to do in writing up more EHRs or non-EHRs, actually, healthcare records, rather than having electronic speech-based true EHRs, right?
And
plenty of work, honestly.
I mean, just echoing what you are saying, I would not want to learn from an app about a devastating disease, to be very honest. That's why I also believe, at least for, I don't know, non-headache stuff, so really serious diseases, I think it needs to be still the last mileage needs to be human. Yeah, but that human is probably not merely a doctor only understanding diseases, but also understanding health, meaning that that doctor needs to evolve more towards a health coach, understanding healthy nutrition, healthy sporting, healthy living and the like. But that someone cannot do that and learn and know that everything by heart themselves. They need to be super tech enabled and insights enabled to be in a position to be a good counter to people, right?
And you know, I speak obviously also from a private context, and I think the game is really changing to doctors more or less publicly acknowledging what they don't know. And that's good, because, I mean, the world of knowledge is flat now.
Yeah,
there is nothing you can't find, Google or whatnot. And I think this transformative role of general practitioners, and I would love them to have much more time for their patients, because that establishes this human relationship. And I think this is so, so, so important, especially if you talk about chronic life-threatening diseases. This is not about your headache. This is about getting diabetes. This is about Alzheimer's. This is about like all the things that are potentially over the longevity terminally fatal.
This leads to another field that I would love us spending a few moments on, which is personalized healthcare. And you alluded to that in a sense, of course. And in one of our previous episodes, I was speaking with Bijoy Sagar, who is the CIO and CDTO at Bayer, leading their digital transformation. And he remarked actually that not technology, but the data in the end will actually make the difference. And he believes that the exciting potential of quantum and others is that it has the ability to perform, as you also said, system-wide modeling, surpassing the limitations of AI. And this then giving a good lever to make healthcare in the end personalized. So given what he said, I would be intrigued asking you, what is your perspective on the role of quantum computing actually making our healthcare, be it disease or preventative care, more personalized?
I think I'd be happy if we get it on quantum chemistry level to work in the first place. Mm-hmm. And then there will be a lot to learn from heuristics. Today, thanks to math, the box will behave to mathematics, which is awesome because that means mm-hmm. we can do all the smart calculation we do today without having the box at hand and invent all these algorithms. But there is an equal open amount of things that we will then see heuristically. Mm-hmm. That is when we have the box at hand, see what else is possible. I purposely stay away from hyping and large-scale systems modeling and whatnot because, again, right, that will have a huge dependency on the hardware and on the algorithms because even if it's possible, if it takes 3 years or the lifespan of five researchers, that's great, but not helpful. Industrially viably helpful. That's the reason why I stay away from that a bit. I think quantum will be able to deliver us more insights that we then can use in other bits and places of this mm-hmm. world to actually derive better decisions.
Yes, for sure.
And when it comes to personalized medicine, this goes back to my data and what can I do with my data? Because again, right, I think, and as CTOs or as engineers, we love technology. Today, there's a second thing we should love. And that is actually to take the time to think about ethics and to think about what we do with that data and what impact that has. Mm-hmm. The best technology, if let loose, might equally kill us. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about AGI and so artificial general intelligence, but other things. But I think it's on us that we work at the forefront of technology to be very well aware of the human impact, to really take sometimes the time to step a little back of the technology excitement and ensure that technology is placed in the right hands. Because at that point, it can be vastly powerful mm-hmm. or reversely, it can just kill us. To go back to personalized medicine, and that's more on the sort of philosophical trail now, I think if I would have everything in one place for now, forget about the fancy assistant of data mm-hmm. and whatnot, that'd be already vastly helpful. To have like literally data from your health records in this case, because you hardly ever just visit one doctor, right? You visit Absolutely. Many doctors, especially if you're a chronic disease, then you visit even more many doctors that may be over the borders of countries, that may be with way different biomarkers and whatnot. And the ability to make sense out of all this. The doctor of my wife tells her usually, by now you have become your own doctor. Because that's life of a chronic patient. Mm. Because Petra is spending a lot of her time reading through scientific papers and whatnot to understand all the things that may help or reversely not at all. And I think that personalized medicine for me is much more the empowerment of a patient. Mm-hmm. Empowerment of a patient to make sense of what's in front of you and then have the doctor discuss that with you. Mm. I think if you listen to people like Bertalan Mesko, he's driving it a slightly different route. But I think of it as the patient and is able to make smart decisions based on the data and being able to connect that under the realm of my data in my place. I'm extremely excited by this. My data, and because my digital ring that I'm wearing is actually keeping me control and is not directly publishing it to the cloud. Very good reason. My data. It's my decision what I do with it.
And are you using it, if I may ask this?
Yeah, of course. I use it. I'll not tell the manufacturer. Mm-hmm. I use it actually both. It measures temperature, which is super helpful to sort of predict if you have a disease or not. And I also, out of curiosity, look sometimes at what are meetings doing to me, right? Ah. What are, like is my heartbeat going crazy or is it just staying because I feel comfortable? So I use it more as like an aid. I'll not let it change my life, but rather to kind of just see some data behind kind of what I live through throughout the day when I'm sitting on the plane, when I'm running to an airport, through an airport. So I use it really just to make me better understand a little bit what's happening in my glorious metabolism.
That's cool. Please do let us know how this podcast that we're doing
you see it measuring right now, actually.
Did something to your body based on the measurement. I'm intrigued to ask one final question because in 2021, Boehringer Ingelheim is actually the first pharma company that went into a collaboration with Google on developing quantum algorithm that are tailored for the pharma industry. And this initiative aims to unlock new capabilities, especially in drug development through a deeper understanding of quantum algorithm design as such. Could you elaborate a bit on this groundbreaking collaboration that you embarked on as Boehringer together with one of the big tech companies, Google? And is there anything that you can already kind of talk about as an achievement over the past 3 years?
So when we announced the partnership with Google Quantum AI with Ryan Babusch and his colleagues, I think a lot of people were like, what the heck? Boehringer pulled this off.
Plus one.
And we are super proud about it, right? Because at the very end, it also shows our commitment to quantum, right? Mm. It shows the quality of researchers that are in the quantum lab and many other things. And one of the things indeed we look at with together with Google Quantum AI is how can we increase the performance of these algorithms? Actually, we did the very first costing of an algorithm for a truly pharma-relevant enzyme. What would it take to calculate it, right? In terms of compute power, in terms of wall clock time, in terms of errors, and many, many other things. So these are the type of things that we do and did with them. We discuss a lot around use cases with them. When it comes to, is that a potential fit? Do we know, or do we need to invest to say, yep, that's a fit or not? I think what people sort of wonder is, what the heck are you guys doing the whole day there? Just because you have an algorithm for something does not mean you have you know what all the possible things are that you can make into this algorithm be able to solve. And a lot of work is going on into that. So you see an algorithm that solves you a very small specific problem and you're like, we don't have any of this problem. Like, why would I even need it? To then really spend time to see, well, is that a more generic problem class I can do something with? Maybe use cases that I've not even thought about that potentially don't come from the chemistry side, but rather, say, from the supply side, from the clinical trial side and other things. So that's sort of part one. And the other part is really to develop new algorithms with them, right? And really bring the algorithms to the edge of their usability and to the edge of their availability. It's cool. It's cool stuff.
What a great ending. Big thanks, Clemens, for taking the time. Very intriguing to see your passion and energy level, your level of expertise that you're having, not only theoretically, but also practically what you're doing already today. And a lot of thought-provoking ideas that you left surely me, but also many of our listeners with. And I can only say once again, thank you for taking the time here with us and looking forward to talking next time, 3 years from now, probably, what actually has changed and re-record it and look back at the time. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Thomas, for having me and spending the time with me. It was a fun talk to also take time to structure the thoughts. How do they fit together? What sort of are the angles and anchors to that? And thank you for also being open for me, sitting sometimes a little bit more on the philosophical side of the world.
Thank you very much for tuning in to today's Strategy and Insider podcast. I really hope that you found it as interesting and thought-provoking as I did. Please do not forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. We really appreciate your support and look forward to bringing you more highly interesting, differentiated episodes in the future. Until then, stay safe.
Strategy made real.